Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is novelist, critic, and translator from the French, Ryan Ruby. And we're talking about his new book, Context Collapse, a poem containing a history of poetry. Ryan, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks for having me on.
I got to ask you, this writing is an experience for the reader. I won't even begin to tell you how it affected me. It was weird because you have on one page, on the verso, is the poem. On the recto, on the right, is your extensive field notes, which are longer than the poem. How did you start this? What inspired this idea for Context Collapse?
Well, just to take the formatting, which is sort of, as you say, somewhat unique for a book of poetry. It was a sort of an evolutionary process. I had, as most artists who are working through an idea, they sort of find the form that best suits the thing that they're trying to do. And in my case, like the other cases, there were a number of sort of false starts. The way it became a poem is quite simply that I was walking to the library where I work, or where I used to work, and the first lines of the poem just sort of popped into my head. And those lines are, at first, the question of the audience is quite simple. Where should it be seated? Huh. And those sort of came to me, you know, as sometimes happens when you're doing a normal task. And I got into the library. I sat down. I opened my notebook. It's a very small red notebook. And I wrote down the lines in the notebook. And I noticed that the lines broke quite evenly into two lines of iambic pentameter.
Yeah.
And quite strangely, I decided, and this is the sort of silly moment, I decided to keep writing in pentameter rather than to treat them as prose and continue that way. And so the idea was that the form of the book should match its content. And as I expanded, I found that one of the constraints of writing in poetry rather than prose is that there's literally a lot less space for digression, for addition of information, or contextualization of an argument, or considering a counter-argument. And at first I tried to put these sort of things in parentheses, but then I found that the parentheses needed parentheses within themselves. And so what I ended up doing was instead of doing that, I changed to footnotes, partway through the process, and it evolved from there. The book itself is very much concerned with how various kinds of media formats change the meaning and look and feel and experience of a work of literature. And so I was quite pleased by this particular sort of process, because what I was doing is the writing was responding to itself, and that was the thing that really interested me in the larger context of the argument of the book.
It's an amazing experience to read, because it's like you're having two different voices simultaneously in your head. Because on the verso, there's a poem which is about poetry. And then the recto, it's like straight on, although it's very funny, is your extensive footnotes. So you're going from this poetic frame of mind to this for academic frame of mind, back and forth simultaneously. And it has a weird effect on the reader.
What I was going for was two things.
One, I'm not saying that was bad, by the way. I'm saying I enjoyed that.
Oh, no. I mean, you know, the idea was there is a sense in which the footnotes provide a kind of dissonance, and that's intended. And what I was going for was two things. One, at first, and again, this is a process that I figured out as I was writing, my first impulse was I wanted to produce the experience of information overload.
Oh, yeah.
Which is referred to in the context of the poem, is referred to in the case of Gertrude Stein and Gertrude Stein's writing about media. And so what I wanted to do is, of course, I'm thinking about poetry as a medium and thinking about the way media functions today. And one of the things I wanted to replicate was our contemporary experience of media consumption, which is information overload. And the second thing that I wanted to do with the two voices idea was that there's an Hispano-Arabic form from the early, let's say, 10th century, 9th and 10th century, and that's called the Muwashsha. And what the Muwashsha does is it's got two parts. It's got a male voice singing in Arabic, which is the sort of classical language of Andalusia, and it has a refrain, which is sung by a female voice in Mos Arabic, which is the vernacular. And so in both of those cases, what I wanted to do was to take a very new experience and a very old experience and reproduce them in the sort of duality of the verso, recto, main text, footnotes, reading experience.
It's really interesting because there are times when there's only one short line of poetry, but a full page of footnotes.
Yeah, so I should say that the way that up till its point of its publication, the way it looked in my Word document was that it was blocks of text, and then the footnotes would sort of be at the bottom of the page. And when it came time to publish it in a book format, my editor and I we had many different conversations, many different ideas about how the Word document should be transferred to the sort of codex book form. And so one of the ideas was that we would reproduce the look of the Word document to the greatest degree possible. And that had the defect of the footnote text would have to be very, very small. It would be hard to read.
Yeah, yeah.
Then we consider just doing the poem with the footnotes in the back, sort of like endnotes. But that had the defect of then making the reader switch back and forth from the beginning pages of the book to the back end of the book, and we were worried that the reader would just like forget about the footnotes. The footnotes are actually where all the action's at, so we wanted to make sure the footnotes were read as sort of sequentially and into the experience of the reading process as possible. And so it was my editor actually who hit upon the idea of the verso recto format layout, and what that entailed was, as you see in the final copy, the thing that you're referring to is that on some lines, the verso or the recto is one or two lines at most because the footnote is long, or one or two lines of footnotes because the poem is long. And what I liked about that is is two things. Once again, here we have an instance of like a media format.
Yep.
Determining the form of the poem, and also the single line on a page or the couple lines on a page gestures towards the modernist layouts of sort of imagistic or of imagism and that tradition of the short poem with large amounts of white space surrounding it. So it did both two things again, right? One, it could be a sort of modernist layout experimentation, like from Mallarmé or Pound, or what it could do while at the same time, what it was is a sort of a blank verse essay in the tradition of Milton or Alexander Pope. And so that was fun, right? And that's sort of an evolving process. The poem's creation and what the poem talks about responds to the conditions of its own production, and that's all very intentional.
Now, the poem is introduced by a razzo and ends with an ostan. Tornada, which is from the Occitan languages. Why did you choose that language for the words for the introduction and the outpost?
Yeah, so what a raso is and what a tornada is, these are features of, as you say, Occitan poetry, which your listeners might be more familiar with from the name of the troubadour tradition.
Yeah, I was wondering, did you want to write a troubadour poem? Is there a sense that this is a troubadour work?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's another formal element is that when I came to write about the troubadours, I wanted to then, you know, shape it so that what it looks like is a troubadour canso, right?
Yeah.
So a canso is, a raso is, there were, the troubadours were primarily singers and they worked primarily in an oral tradition, but their work was written down. And after the troubadour tradition sort of dies out, in southern France, later sort of catalogers, what they would do is they would write vivas or biographies of the various different troubadours and razos, which is sort of short, several paragraph long bits of literary criticism introducing the poem, explaining what the poem was about. And so the idea here is that instead of calling an introduction, I would call it a raso. And then the poem ends, right? So in the last section of the poem, in the last canto of the poem radically changes form from being a verse essay to a poem in a more
traditional,
familiar sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But also
it's written in terms of rima, and it just formally departs from the rest of the poem. And the word tornada, in this case, it means turn. And so it turns away, as the endings of troubadour poems would often do. And in the end of a troubadour poem, the tornada would often address the jongleur, who is the person who would perform it at a court far away from the place in which it was originally written. And so the idea is that that the tornada ends on a formally different note, but it also ends with an address to the reader.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is novelist, critic, and translator from the French, Ryan Ruby. And we're talking about his new book, Context Collapse, a poem containing a history of poetry. Ryan, I think you write that you believe poetry is the original media technology?
Yeah, that's right.
Elaborate on that.
Yeah, so that's the proposition I'm defending. The idea here is that way back when, and so the poem starts in Bronze Age Greece.
Yep.
And the idea is to sort of figure out how we came up with the things that we consider poetic form. And the condition of Bronze Age Greece, out of which the Homeric poems are produced, is very interesting, namely that that's a society that has no writing at all.
Yeah.
Right? This is, Greece does not have a writing system at the time.
They were just recited from memory, right? They were passed down from one poet to the next.
Bingo, that's it, right? And so these bards, this group of bards who travel from, you know, town to town, place to palace to palace, tavern to tavern, are reciting these poems from memory. And in order to, and so what I argue is that metrical forms, so the heroic hexameter of the Homeric poems, as well as the famous epithets, like Rosy Fingered Dawn and the Wine Dark Sea, there's a long sort of literary critical anthropological tradition which argues that in fact what they were doing, these bards, they were memorizing, storing and disseminating large bits of information, right? This is the way that society held on to valuable pieces of information in the absence of writing. And so poetry, the poem itself, becomes a what the historian and philosopher Eric Havelock calls the encyclopedia of ancient Greece. It records how many ships, your particular city-state went to Troy. It records how to perform a sacrifice. It records how to set up a ship properly. It records various values that needed to be transmitted and preserved. And the way it does this, right, in the absence of writing, is you have to memorize all this information. And as is well known, and as you may think from how easy it is to remember information when it's put into a song, right, a pop song, for example, right, these bards would find it easier to remember and more compelling to transmit if it were put in the form of a story and if that story was metrical.
Now, what happens to the social function of poetry once writing comes into play?
Oh, numerous things. And the writing, alphabetic writing gets introduced into Greece in sometime in the, so far as we know, in the 8th century from the Near East. And the great Greek invention is to add vowels, right? To add letter forms that represent vowels. And some theorists, some historians, classicists, even suggested the whole reason that they imported the alphabet, or rather the abjad, into ancient Greece and added vowels was for the purpose of transcribing the Homeric epics themselves. That is a going theory. And what happens is, and many things happen when writing is introduced. And they happen very slowly for various reasons. And the sort of oral tradition of poetry specifically doesn't really ever die out, and it doesn't really become a secondary tradition in places like Europe and the United States until the mid-19th century. But one thing that happens when you have writing is that you no longer have to be present to experience the poem, right? So if a poem is being sung to you, you have to be in the physical presence and temporal presence of the person who's doing the singing. But when it's written down, right, there's a time gap and a space gap between you and the poem. When it's written down, you can, and this is an interesting, this isn't a very interesting thing, you can start to charge for it.
Huh. So it becomes a commodity?
Issue, right? It becomes a commodity, right, exactly. So around the 6th century, about 100 years later, then the alphabet gets introduced. Coinage starts being introduced in ancient Greece. And the original poems that are being written down, right? So previously, if you're a Homeric bard, there's no way to monetize what you do, really. and so what you're doing is you're engaged in a gift economy that is regulated according to the sort of customs of hospitality. You go, you sing your song. If the king likes your song, they, put you up for the night. They buy you dinner. They, maybe if they really like it, they give you a new lyre. They give you some clothes and so on and so forth. But it's not an exchange. It's like, oh, I gave you a gift of my song. And the other person's like, oh, I loved your gift. Here, have a gift of some really nice food or some wine or something, right? But when the alphabet gets introduced, right, you can write these things down.
That's right.
And they're either being written down on papyrus, which comes from Egypt, and it's tightly controlled by the Egyptian government as a very valuable commodity, or it's being chiseled into stone. And you can start to say, okay, I'm chiseling this thing into stone for you. So each of these letters is going to cost you, the person I'm chiseling the stone for you, because there's labor involved, there's a physical object involved, there's capital involved, right? Stone and the tools used to make it. And we can make this a monetary exchange. And so the first person who's thought to do this is a poet, a very interesting person, called Simonides of Chios, of Chios, I think. And he's the first person to charge for his work. Now, of course, let's just take a huge leap into the future, right? When you get the printing press, right, in the middle of the 15th century, now you go from having a handmade object to a mass-produced object.
And we're going to run out of time, Ryan, and I want to make sure I include some of the 20th and 21st century stuff that's in your book.
Yeah, of course.
Because connected to that is what happens in the late 20th and early, and 21st century, because there's a mimeo revolution and zines come about, mm-hmm. and people are self-publishing now. And a weird thing happens about the commodity of poetry. As you write in the book, many poor people write poetry, then read it.
Absolutely. And so one of the sort of impulses for this project is trying to understand the contemporary in poetry by going all the way back to the very archaic past. Because those two periods of time, strangely enough, although they're very distant from each other, they have a lot to say to each other. We have a lot to learn about the present moment from an examination of Homer's time. Because, in fact, the media situations, they seem very radically different, but in fact, they're structurally parallel. But to the point that you're making, one of the strange things about our time is that more poetry is being produced than at any time in history. And yet, in the cultures which produce so much poetry, poetry seems to be a very marginal form, right?
Yeah.
And it's not something that is sort of central to our culture. And I was like, well, this is very strange, right? It's on the one hand, it's the most democratic it's ever been. And on the other hand, it's the least central it's ever been. And the hypothesis that I have, drawing on sort of the statistics you refer to about how many people submit to poetry magazines versus how many people buy them, how many volumes of poetry are produced, including self-publication, which, of course, with the internet and sort of cheap printing options, has become sort of ubiquitous. And the answer is, what's happened is that supply of poetry has so far exceeded demand of poetry that in a market, that essentially the price has gone to zero, right? So on the one hand, we've returned to the condition in which poetry is no longer a commodity.
Right.
A commodity whose de facto worth is zero. But on the other hand, the cultural context has so radically changed from, let's say, the gift economy of Greece, that we're living in a market society, and the value of a thing to a culture in a market society is the price that it can command. Right. And so this is one way of explaining this sort of weird paradox about why it is that so many people write poetry and poetry is so marginal in our culture. And the answer is it has to do with market conditions in a society where market conditions are the ne plus ultra of understanding value.
And as you write in the book, the piece of paper that the poem is worth on is written on is worth more than the poem written on it. And actually, the poem devalues the value of the paper.
Indeed. That's a quote from a publisher, Roof Books publisher, James Sherry. And I will never forget the moment that was said to me. It was quoted to me at a lecture. And I had a light bulb experience. My jaw dropped. And I just crystallized my understanding of how poetry relates to the economy at present.
We're going to run out of time, but there's one more, and you write about this extensively in this. AI and the generation of poetry by computer, algorithms, and automation, that has a whole other effect on poetry too.
Absolutely, and that's a very present debate at the moment, right? That's pretty recent. It seems to be all we're talking about for the last couple months. What is the relationship between AI and literature? Can AI produce poems that are of the same quality as those produced by human beings? Is that time coming fast? And my argument to that, just in the brief amount of time that we have left, is that the reason we're even that comparison is based on a fundamental misunderstanding of what poetry really is, and that misunderstanding has been nurtured through about 100 years of a sort of error in literary criticism, according to which a poem is essentially an object, that is a series of words on a page, the verbal icon of new criticism. However, my argument is, and I think this is true, is that poetry has never been merely an object or even primarily an object. It's a social relationship. And that I think this is true for all art in general. But what art is not a series of objects. It's a relationship between, in this case, a poet and their audience, and how that relationship exists within the society and within the technological and economic conditions of its time. And so whether or not, ChatGPT will be able to reproduce a very high-quality poem is quite irrelevant to the making of the poem, because ultimately what ChatGPT cannot reproduce is the same kind of relationship that poets have always had with their audiences. Indeed, what it's trying to do is replace that relationship, so that relationship doesn't exist anymore.
We're completely out of time, and I hope the audience can realize that we could be talking about this book for hours. I want to thank you for the word stooplime, which is a combination of stupid and sublime. I'd never heard of that
credit
before.
Credit to CNN Live for that.
There is so much in this book. It's incredible. And it's a reading experience, too. My guest tonight is novelist, critic, translator from the French, Ryan Ruby. And we're talking about his new book, Context Collapse, A Poem Containing a History of Poetry. Ryan, it's been a real pleasure.
Thanks for having me on, Mark. It's been a great time. I really enjoyed it.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.